the sports leader. Sports Radio 66 and 101.9 FM.
The Fan.
And joining us now, the director of the documentary we'll all be looking at Monday night at 9 on HBO, and is James Friedman. And James, thanks for a couple of minutes.
Oh, I appreciate it, Steve. Every time I come to New York, I'm always up late because of California time listening to you.
Well, you might be the only one.
Okay, well, I'm a loyal fan base then.
Well, you're very kind. And I know this is your third time. I heard one of the interviews that you did with Jody McDonald. I think you had been on with Tony Page as well. So this is number three for you. And I'm surprised it's only three times, because everybody at this radio station more than interested in the legacy and the career of a guy that established quite a level of excellence for a lot of other guys. It wasn't long ago, James, we had Vince Scully on for a couple of minutes, and he said he learned from Red Barber not to listen to other announcers and not to be opinionated. Was Marty like that with a lot of the young people and older people, too, that he touched and might have given advice to? Would he have said the same thing?
No. Marty would not have said the same thing. Marty would have said, be true to yourself. But Marty had a very specific way. He mentored so many broadcasters, Marv Albert, Bob Costas. The list is so long. But he believed in an economy of words. And in fact, in an, honoring him when I wrote the narration to the film, I tried to use such a sparse language as possible to do the narration, because that's how he would have wanted it. Same thing with the title, Glickman. You know, Marty was a very... Mm-hmm. straightforward, plain, in the best sort of sense, man, and I wanted the title just to convey that. So Marty believed in the basics of broadcasting, and for the listeners who may be too young to know, Marty Glickman revolutionized radio basketball play-by-play. By that I mean he coined the phrases used today, the lane, the key, the midcourt stripe, his most famous one, swish. And gave listeners the geography of the court. Before Marty Glickman, a basketball broadcast, it's going to sound crazy, but it sounded like this. Summers passes to Friedman, he scores. You didn't know where anyone was on the court. He would say, Summers dribble along the right sideline, throws a behind-the-back pass to the top of the key to Friedman, who banks in a two-handed set shot, when they used to have set shots back in that day. And as Larry King said, he was television on radio. And Mike Breen had a great quote. It was as if his voice was attached to the ball.
By the way, Summers would have resulted in a turnover. And there no, would
got
not
the ball we, at the top of the key.
Yeah, we would have been going the other way with that possession. And Marv, of course, said when he was a kid, he was not only trying to talk like Marty Glickman, but walk like him as well. And it's so ironic, because Marty, right away in your documentary, was talking about he didn't walk anywhere, he ran.
Yeah. Marty had a real love of running, and it gave him a huge advantage in any sport he played as a kid. The other thing, I worked for Marty Glickman, and I never realized, to me, he was the great Giants announcer, and I didn't have any idea what a world-class athlete this man was. He was a great football player at Syracuse University, and at one time in 1936 was the third fastest man in the world behind Jesse Owens and Ralph Metcalf. The problem was he had to race against those two guys, but, you know, what can you do?
What was interesting in the documentary, there were so many things that were fascinating. I love the footage that you had.
Yeah.
With Madison High School taking on Sid Luckman and Erasmus High School of Brooklyn, and Marty outrunning Sid and outplaying him, maybe a better word to use, with that Madison High School beating Luckman's Erasmus team. And that footage, I mean, to die for, that kind of footage.
Yeah, it's, you know, people say, how long did it take to make the film? And I say, it took a year to make it and 2 years to find and beg for free footage. You know, you find things. A guy at Paramount Newsreels said, listen, we have this very grainy black and white videotape. It's not labeled. It's from that era. Maybe Marty Glickman's in it. And I had to wait 6 months. You couldn't make out any of the figures. It was so snowy. I had to wait 6 months to on spec transfer the nitrate 35 millimeter film, and then there's this crystal clear race of Marty Glickman running. It was like you hit the lottery.
Yeah, and listen, I mean, as a running back at Syracuse, I mean, the man was an athlete, and as you point out, an Olympian. And 1936, we certainly know from Hitler not wanting Jewish people to run, and there were two Jews on the U.S. Track and field team, and Marty, of course, one of them. But I'm wondering how much resistance, I mean, from Avery Brundage and the track coach. I mean, there were people who knew Marty and knew how good he was running, and he was going to be running in, what was it, the 400-meter relay. And, of course, he couldn't run in any event, including that one. But, were they appeasing? Was Avery Brundage, who I always thought was an anti-Semite to begin with, I think he didn't have to do any anything with Hitler at all to make sure that Marty wasn't going to run in that 1936 Olympics.
You know, it actually even started at the U.S. Olympic trials. Marty had come in third, and the first three finishers were guaranteed to represent the U.S. in the 100-meter race, which was the marquee event in the world to see who the fastest man in the world was. And he was knocked down from third place to fifth place, and this was before photo finish. The assistant track coach of the Olympic team, Dean Cromwell, put his two USC runners ahead of Marty Glickman. Mm-hmm. So Marty was relegated down to the relay team along with the other Jewish runner, Sam Stoller. And then the day of the race, after Hitler had watched all the great black athletes led by Jesse Owens, John Woodruff, Ralph Metcalf, just smashed to smithereens this myth of Nazi Aryan supremacy. The next day, Glickman and Stoller's race was scheduled, and by all accounts, they were going to win by 15 yards. And, the idea of Hitler having to witness two Jews standing on the winning podium was too much. Some people say it was track politics through Dean Cromwell why Marty didn't run. Marty believed it was anti-Semitism. Avery Brundage and Dean Cromwell, the assistant coach, both were members of America First, a Nazi-sympathizing organization in its latter years. And I also have proof that at the 2 years after the Olympics, when the Nazis were building the German embassy in Washington, D.C., they awarded the construction contract to Avery Brundage's company.
Yeah.
That certainly sounds like a payoff to me for thanking him.
And Jesse Owens, I wasn't aware of this, learned it by watching your documentary, was going to what? Boycott the 400-meter relay because the two Jewish guys were not going to be in it.
Jesse didn't want to get an opportunity to run at the expense of other people. And there have even been conflicting reports. He didn't say what Marty said. He said that he would give up his spot. But I have audio evidence of Mac Robinson, Jackie Robinson's older brother, who was one of the Olympians, in the room with Marty, confirming what Marty said. Jesse did speak up and say, I don't want to do this. I've won my three gold medals. And there's even footage of him leaving the United States to go to Berlin and saying, I can't wait to come back with three gold medals, not four. So he never had any intention of running in that race, but they forced him to.
And I noticed at the very end of the documentary that after the 1936 Olympics, in a 400-meter relay race, Stoller and Marty Glickman running set a world record.
It wasn't Stoller. It was Marty got a chance to run with Jesse and with Ralph Metcalf and Frank Wyckoff.
Okay.
And, yes, they set a world record. And when you see that with the audience, a hush comes over the crowd because it's vindication, and yet it's so poignant that how could they not have let this guy, this champion, get an opportunity to race?
After his athletic days and he began his broadcasting career, he runs into the Jewish issue again as the voice of the NBA and replaced because more of what? That he was Jewish and more like sounding like he was from New York, and he's replaced, is he not, by Lindsey Nelson?
Yes, who happened to be a wonderful broadcaster. Met fans remember Lindsey.
Sure.
But you also have to, in fairness to NBC and the NBA, you do have to put that in the perspective of the time. That was an era when every movie star changed his name. I mean, Dean Martin was Dino Crosetti. Every single person, they wanted to present a white bread, middle America view to the public. So Marty was probably 10 years too early in his career, because the truth is, till Howard Cosell, there was no known national Jewish broadcaster. Mel Allen, I never knew as a kid, was Mel Israel.
Mm-hmm.
I didn't, you know, you didn't really know about that. But Marty was proud of being Jewish, would not change his name, and it clearly did hurt him. Whether it was being too New York or too Jewish, he lost an opportunity to stay with the NBA on a national level. And frankly, that was something that always bothered Marty. You know, when I went to move to the Midwest and later California, I tell people about, I worked for Marty Glickman once, and they would say, who's Marty Glickman? They, you know, and so I feel if my film can remedy that even a little bit and give him national recognition, it will have been a success.
James Friedman is our guest, and he, of course, the director of Glickman, the HBO documentary at 9 o'clock on Monday night. Tell us what happened, how he lost his job as voice of the New York Football Giants.
You know, it's one of those situations where new management came into WNEW, and as you know, working in radio, you know, when the radio stations get the rights to football games, sometimes, and the announcers don't always go with them, they played hardball in the negotiations with Marty. The season was coming up. He did not have a new contract. His old producing partner had moved to the Jets. They offered him twice the amount of money. He said, no, I'm a Giants broadcaster. But when a new offer never came, he took the Jet job. The next day, WNEW offered him a contract, and it was too late to go back to the Giants. And those people who screwed up those negotiations were let go by WNEW 6 months later.
Yeah. And he did with the Jets, of course, as people also know, and still didn't forget from with the high school. And one thing that came through in your documentary, how giving he was, how he loved teaching and offering, you know, to help whoever he could help. He seemed to be so selfless. He seemed to be so giving of his time. And it's not always that way with a lot of people who reach the top the way he did.
It's actually rare, I found out. But he not only instituted the high school game of the week, you know, at a time when he was in the peak of his career. He was Friday night, he was doing the Knick games, Saturday night, Yonkers Raceway, Sunday he was doing the Giant football games, and he made time to go to a high school and, you know, somewhere in the metropolitan area on a freezing cold Sunday morning to do the high school game of the week for 16 years. And at halftime, he'd bring on the glee club, the chess club, the debate team. This wasn't just about the jocks. This was to show people that kids were doing wonderful things in the school district. And he also worked extensively with the Police Athletic League. And then in terms of mentoring all these people, Charlie Steiner, the Dodger announcer, told me a story. He said he was doing USFL football, and he gets a call from Marty, who he didn't know personally.
Mm-hmm.
Marty said, you know, what are you doing tomorrow? And he thought it was a prank call. He says, I don't know. What am I doing? He says, why don't you come over with your tapes? We'll go over them. And Charlie said he learned more in the 3 hours that day with Marty Glickman than he had in the previous 15 years of his career.
And I think what makes your documentary is that there is so much of Marty in it. Before he passed away, of course, in 2001. But there is a lot of Marty talking a lot about some of the events that, you know, we're talking about right now, whether it was with the Giants or the 36th Olympics. And he actually returned to that stadium from 1936 when the Giants, were they not, playing an exhibition game in Germany.
He has very very difficult time. He was walking down the track. This is 50 years on the track he didn't have the chance to run on. And all of a sudden, this anger and bitterness that he didn't know was within him burst out of him. He started screaming, cursing, and this was not a man who did that. And he couldn't believe that they would do this, not just to him, but to any 18-year-old kid and crush their dreams. And in fact, when I saw that footage, I knew the theme of my film. And it's what happens when an 18-year-old kid's dreams are crushed by racism and prejudice. Do they become bitter or do they thrive? Marty Glickman not only thrived in life, but he used sports as a means of transcending the divisions created by race, class, and religion. This was a real mensch.
Yeah. A mention, a mentor.
Yes.
And again, how long did it take you to put this together and to gather all of what you were able to get video-wise? And how long did it take you to get everything together and put everything together?
Yeah, it was, you know, it was 3 years.
3 years.
Mm-hmm.
And was this your first film?
Yes, yes. I'd been a working writer in Hollywood for many years, but I had never made a film before, so this was my first film.
And of course, from any previews, from what people have seen, everything favorable, thumbs up?
I feel like I'm dreaming. The Daily News this morning and the Wall Street Journal yesterday, and I had seen this film play at film festivals, but you know, I couldn't wait to bring it to New York because it. What I wanted to do is make a film that plays for anybody. You don't need to know sports. You don't need to know about Marty Glickman. And in fact, Martin Scorsese, the executive producer of the film, mm-hmm. who knows nothing about sports, he barely knew half the people in the film. He was so taken by Marty's story, he became involved and helped me get it to HBO. So that's what's incredibly gratifying about it, that, you know, this is a film that Marty's life is so incredible that I feel very privileged to share his story with the public.
What do you take from it?
You know, it's very interesting you say that. When I was editing this film and he gets knocked down at the Olympics and then he's the voice of college basketball and the scandals hit, which he had nothing to do with, but his career is sort of derailed then. Then he goes to the NBA and he's taken off, for whether he's too New York, too Jewish, whatever, and just one hit after another. And I was saying, my God, are people going to like not want to watch the rest of the film because he's getting knocked down so much? So I showed it to some friends and they said, you're looking at this backwards. We're not seeing him knocked down. We're seeing him continue to get up.
Hmm.
And Marty Glickman not overcame these obstacles, you know, continually. He did it with grace and style.
James, I can't thank you enough for, you know, spending some time with me and us this afternoon. No, a pleasure. And we really I saw your documentary last Sunday, so I've already seen it, and I can assure you I'll be watching again.
Thank you. It'll be on HBO Monday at 9 o'clock, the 26th. And if they want to follow more information about Marty, I'm on Twitter at Glickman the Film. My website's GlickmanTheFilm.com and Facebook Glickman the Film. We have a bunch of clips from the film, pictures of Marty and stories, and we'll love it.
And James not being shy about plugging himself.
No, HBO told me to do this. This is my first rodeo, Steve, so I'm learning how to do this.
Well, listen, I'm sure you'll be doing more from what I saw and from what we're all going to see. Thanks again for a couple of minutes, James.
I really appreciate it, Steve. You have a great day.
Yeah, you too. All right, James Friedman, the director of Glickman, Monday night at 9. All right, 1-877-337-6666. That is the number to call. Another hour and a half to go or so before Metropolitan Extra at 325. It's a Harvey Day. On the Fan and in New York City.